You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Anti-Defamation League recently reported that nearly 20,000 anti-Semitic tweets were directed at more than 800 journalists who have been critical of Donald Trump since his campaign began. And David Duke, the former Ku Klux Klan leader, recently qualified to debate his opponents for a Louisiana Senate seat by registering 5.1% in the Mesa-Dixon poll. Sarah Posner and David Nywert's article, How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, is in the current issue of Mother Jones. It was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. I'm very pleased it has brought them to our show. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Sarah, you conducted a three-month investigation which involved interviewing white nationalist leaders. Who are some of the most important nationalist leaders apart from David Duke?
Well, David Duke is of a particular strand of the white nationalist movement, but there's a new movement that has taken a particular interest in Donald Trump. It's known as the alt-right, and its leaders are white nationalists, and some of its leaders include some prominent Trump supporters, like Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute, Peter Brimelow, who runs an anti-immigrant website called VDARE, and Jared Taylor, who runs a website called American Renaissance, which promotes bogus science that purports to prove that white people are of higher intelligence than non-white people.
Were they eager to talk to you?
Spencer was eager to talk to me. He's pretty open with journalists and pretty free-willing in his willingness to talk to journalists. I also talked to Brimelow and Taylor, as well as Kevin McDonald, who runs a website called The Occidental Observer, and he was also willing to talk to me for the story.
Spencer has said, "Our dream is a new society, an ethno-state that would be a gathering point for all Europeans." Mm-hmm. But he rejects the word racist because he says it's pejorative.
Well, he on the alt-right, they often use the word racialist to describe their ideology. Race is definitely at the root of everything that they talk about. Race matters the most to them, more than any other issue. It is the core of what they believe. They believe that white people are superior to non-white people. And Spencer very openly advocates what he calls a white ethno-state.
David, you also looked at social media networks. How did you tap into these those networks? And how well-known are the sites?
Well, we tried to examine, you know, we basically spent a lot of time trawling through these websites, but we also, and going through Twitter accounts. But we decided to try to do a more systematic analysis of the social media aspect of it. So we compiled a series of hashtags that were going to actually make a difference, or, you know, that were the ones that were being heavily used by these folks. And we wound up putting together, you know, an analysis of who in the Trump campaign was connecting to this stuff. And it turned out to be fairly revealing.
What are some of the hashtags?
A substantial number of them.
What are some of those hashtags?
Oh, it's just things as white genocide. That's the real popular one among white nationalists because they believe that their motto is that, you know, multiculturalism or diversity equals white genocide. And and there are others, you know, some of them that we looked at included phrases that were common to white nationalists and peculiar to them. We tried to make them, you know, phrases that the white nationalists tended to use only among themselves. They have their own lingo, such as cucks or cuckservatives, which is their way of suggesting that mainstream conservatives have been cuckolded or, you know, are sexually humiliated people. And or the, you know, phrases, some of them are overtly racist, such as they're dismissive word for Black Lives Matter activists is dindus, which is a short for dindu nuffin, which is,
Now, you also listened to nearly 100 hours of Fringe talk radio. Who broadcasts those things?
I'm sorry,
Well,
I wasn't able to hear the
Sarah,
question.
you want to answer?
sure. So a lot of these this talk
My
radio
connection's
is
bad.
broadcast through podcasting. So much of it is on the web, although some of the radio that we listen to is broadcast locally by maybe a local AM station, such as the show called The Political Cesspool, which is broadcast by James Edwards, a white nationalist who actually had gotten press credentials to cover and broadcast from a Trump rally in Tennessee back in February, and also got credentials to cover the Republican National Convention. And we also listen to a lot of Breitbart Radio, which is broadcast on Sirius XM and also available on the web in a podcast. So it varies, but a lot of the very hardcore white nationalist radio and alt-right radio tends to be internet-based only.
Now, you mentioned Breitbart Radio. Breitbart News is that online news outlet that Mr. Trump's campaign CEO Steve Bannon used to head. And they
Right.
describe the alt-right as, quote, the intellectuals who are a much smarter group of people. They're dangerously bright.
Well, that was from a story that was written by Milo Yiannopoulos, who is Breitbart's technology editor, but has been a big promoter of the alt-right. And he identified some of the people that I mentioned earlier in the broadcast as the intellectual core of the alt-right. Interestingly, though, a lot of them don't really consider Yiannopoulos or Breitbart to be alt-right because it's not as it's not as white nationalist as they are, and they consider themselves to be the intellectual vanguard of that. However, I think they see Breitbart as useful in spreading and promoting their ideology and certainly in advocating for Trump and his campaign.
I'm speaking with Sarah Posner and David Neiwirth. Their article in called How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream is in the current issue of Mother Jones, written or reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. David, your article begins with what you call the first warning sign in June 2015, when Donald Trump announced that he would build a wall to keep out Mexican criminals and rapists. Were you surprised that instead of this statement being considered a big mistake, it became one of the most important campaign promises he's made?
I think a lot of people were shocked by it. Certainly, when I was observing it, I thought, well, that's probably going to kill this candidacy right there. And instead, he picked up steam. So I think that was a pretty good sign that there was something afoot. And, I've been tracking this for a long time. I mean, we were also surprised that all these white supremacists started picking him up. Partly because that was just not something that they had typically done for most of the elections that I've been around and observing for many years. Typically, the white supremacist leaders will go for whoever is, some fringe candidate that more reflects their point of view. So I think in both regards, it was there was a lot of surprise involved with what the early steps of the campaign. And then once the stuff got locked into place, it became very clear, especially as we looked at the polling data, what the nature of the phenomenon was.
12 days after Trump's speech, Andrew Anglin, the publisher of the neo-Nazi site Daily Stormer, called Trump the only candidate who's even talking about anything at all that matters. And you quote Jared Taylor, who runs American Renaissance, which you mentioned earlier, is saying that Trump may be the last hope for a president who would be good for white people. Now, doesn't American Renaissance state that its history was that it was founded as a think tank dedicated to scientifically proving white supremacy?
Yeah, that's cool. Go ahead,
Go
Sarah.
ahead.
You've talked to Jared more than I have, so.
You've spoken to Jared, Sarah?
Yeah, so I talked to Taylor, and, you know, he very much believes, much as much of the alt-right believes, that white Americans are at risk of being dispossessed of their heritage, perhaps, you know, in the alt-right parlance, at risk of experiencing a white genocide owing to what they call cultural Marxism or multiculturalism or diversity. So they have a thought in their heads that white people are being crushed and their heritage destroyed by these demographic and cultural changes in the United States.
But white people still make the most money, actually wind up in generally with a leg up in America. What examples did they give?
Well, certainly, you know, they believe that, I don't know how to defend this position. I'm not defending this position at all. But they don't look at that. Okay, they look what they are looking at is they're trying to create a frame of mind in their followers that they are being victimized. This is a way of them portraying themselves as the victims of diversity or multiculturalism or whatever they want to call it. And that's why they look to Trump. They think that Trump gives voice to their concerns when he talks about Mexicans as rapists, because then he's portraying non-white people as criminals, as interlopers. You know, when he talks about Muslims needing to be banned, when he talks about needing to build a wall and making Mexico pay for it, this really appeals to them, and they really like the way, in Spencer's words, that he says all of these things with gusto, right? To them, he's not pussyfooting around the issues that they care about. He's really making it clear that there's in their minds, that there's a distinction between white people and non-white people and between Americans and, you know, people who might be, in their mind, interlopers or invaders.
Which would include Native Americans who were here before, but that's a whole other issue.
Right.
What did the leaders and their followers have in common apart from their fear of whites? Is it geography, income, education? Do these people largely live in white communities, or are they living in integrated ones?
It actually goes all across the board on that. I mean, you'll find an incredible diversity among these people, including, you know, some of them are very well educated. So, I mean, the sort of cliche is that these people are all hicks living out in the sticks, and that's just not accurate. There's a lot of folks who are suburban. We've found over the years that it tends to attract a lot of folks from the engineering field and from business fields. You know, it's an incredibly diverse, actually, kind of movement. And
what about women? What percentage of women follow the alt-right?
Yeah, I would say that it's probably close to 70-30. That would be my,
yeah,
if I
actually,
had to answer to guess.
Actually more like 80-20, but right.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that what you said, the people you included are among the most advantaged in America, in engineers and bankers.
Yeah, that's right. No, it has to do with, in a lot of ways, what it actually tracks with is authoritarianism. A lot of people, these folks are deeply authoritarian, and they want a sort of authoritarian leader, which is what Trump represents for them.
You're saying that they think fascism would be a good idea. They're non-democratic.
Oh yeah. No, I think that's very explicit in a lot of their stuff.
Is that why they call him Emperor Trump in some cases?
Indeed, that is exactly why.
And talking about social media and some of the phrases and words that they use on social media, one of them is "fashy haircut" to describe the specific kind of haircut that a lot of younger men in the alt-right have, and "fashy" meaning, you know, fascist haircut. So.
And what would a fascist haircut look like?
Well, very short around the sides, Richard Spencer popularized that. So if you look at a photograph of him, that's pretty much personifies the fascia haircut.
I've seen young men with that haircut, short around the side, but a lot on the top. I never thought of it as a political statement. Should I have?
Well, I'm not saying that everybody who had their hair cut that way subscribes to this, but within the alt-right, having that haircut is a signifier.
We have to take a little break. I'm going to take a little time and have somebody trim my hair right now. My guests are Sarah Posner and David Neywood. Am I mispronouncing your name?
It's Nyward.
Nyward. Okay. Their article, How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, is in the current issue of Mother Jones. It was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, and we'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with David Nyward and Sarah Posner. Their article, How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, is in the current issue of Mother Jones. It was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. The Trump campaign endorsers include Don Black, a former Grand Dragon of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, founder of the neo-Nazi site Stormfront, Rocky Sahida, chair of the American Nazi Party, Rachel Pendergraft, a national organizer for the Knights Party, the successor of David Duke's Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. You mentioned Richard Spencer, who declared that Trump loves white people, and that's why he's supporting him. And some of the endorsements that they give are rather shocking. I'm not sure I should read any of them on the air.
Yeah, it gets pretty vile, I have to tell you. We had to take long showers after each day of doing this work. So
and listening to some of the podcasts, I imagine.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Some of the endorsements are, only Trump can turn back the brown tide. Another, I will always hate the Jew. This government is run by an evil group of people, and please vote for Trump. Another, the survival of the current political, economic, and cultural system is a death sentence for the European-American population. Our people just needed a viable candidate, and they've identified Trump as that man. And this is the ugliest. The biggest story in the filthy kike media has been a few lines from Melania's speech, which these Jews claim she stole from Monkey Michelle. And that was a Trump endorser, wrote that during the Republican National Convention.
Yeah, pretty mild, actually.
I think it's important to point out here that we went to the Trump campaign several times with this list of a little over 20 endorsers, with the precise language of their endorsement, the precise language of other things that these individuals have written. We gave the Trump campaign several opportunities to distance themselves or disavow these endorsements, and they said nothing. So, you know, if you hearken back to the time when the media was pressing Trump to disavow David Duke, and he did so rather reluctantly and only under rather significant pressure from the anchors on CNN and other programs. And in this case, he did nothing. And it's also important to point out that the disavowal of David Duke was rather perfunctory and a little half-hearted, and white nationalists viewed it in a rather positive way, in the sense that they really didn't see it as an actual disavowal.
In fact, why do you think he hasn't disavowed these other people, since the people who we're talking about would just dismiss that as, you know, doing the political thing?
Well, throughout the campaign, there's been a little bit of a back and forth where he does something. We document this in the article. He does something like retweet a tweet from an account whose handle is White Genocide TM, you know, White Genocide trademark. And that is seen on the alt-right and among white nationalists as evidence that he's one of them, that he's been, in their words, red-pilled, which is their phrase taken from the Matrix movie for when somebody has seen the light of their ideology. And because he, you know, so he goes back and forth where he'll retweet something or he'll not really disavow David Duke, and then he'll do another retweet, say, of the anti-Semitic image of Hillary Clinton with the Star of David and the pile of cash. And all of this is kind of a back and forth with the alt-right where he's never really distanced himself from them, and they see his behavior as validation of their point of view.
Didn't Trump retweet a graphic that claimed that black people were responsible for 81% of white homicides?
Yes.
Now, yeah. PolitiFact has looked into that. That is, they called it wildly inaccurate.
Oh, it's based on statistics, fake statistics that were produced by the Council of Conservative Citizens, which, as you may recall, was the organization that helped inspire Dylann Roof on his rampage and in Charleston, South Carolina. And, you know, these fake statistics have been floating around for quite a few years there on the extremist right. And yeah, it's all stuff that they just cook up. Trump just, casually retreated it as evidence of his, position on black civil rights. He also retweeted an image of himself as Pepe the Frog, for God's sake. You know, I mean, that's the alt-right mascot right there. And he's become a symbol, unfortunately, of outright anti-Semitism and racism.
My guests are David Nywert, who is the author of numerous books, including And Hell Followed With Her, Crossing the Dark Side of the American Border, which won the 2014 International Latino Book Award for Nonfiction, and Sarah Posner, who has written for The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Atlantic, Salon, The Nation, American Prospect, Al Jazeera America, and other publications. And they are the co-authors of an article that is in the current issue of Mother Jones called How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Not just Donald Trump, but haven't some of the, hasn't Donald Jr. been accused of engaging in some of this activity?
Yes, yeah, he's been retweeting some of this as well, and a lot of these tweets are still up on their accounts. I mean, you can go there today and look right at them. They're pretty unapologetic about it.
A listener, Carilli Basin, tweeted us and wonders, is it fair to saddle Trump with the language of his endorsers?
Well, I'd say he has had the opportunity to distance himself from these endorsers. And I'll give you a contrast just to give you a sense of how much the Republican Party has changed in 8 years. In 2008, John McCain, who was then the Republican nominee, distanced himself from a televangelist named Rod Parsley, who when it was revealed that Parsley had written that Islam is a false religion that must be destroyed. And McCain couldn't distance himself fast enough from Parsley in that political environment. In the current political environment, that statement by Parsley seems mild compared, and not that it's not terrible, but it seems mild compared to a lot of what we're seeing in the current political environment. And not only has Trump not, you know, he hasn't distanced himself at all. He's given these followers fodder by retweeting their memes and clearly speaking to their concerns. And he cannot be ignorant of the fact that they are thrilled with what he is saying. And remember, we've had several points in the campaign when the media wondered whether he was going to, quote-unquote, soften his position on immigration. And he has not done that. He's only dug further in. And this is the constituency that has cheered him on in hardening his position on immigration as opposed to softening it.
Now, obviously, we're not convincing all of our listeners. A caller wonders if the graphic depicting that black people are responsible for 81% of white homicides is wildly inaccurate, and wonders what the real number is.
Well, the real numbers are very different than what they put up at the Council of Conservative Citizens, let me tell you. And really, there was a full analysis done at the time that, you know, we could direct readers to. I don't know. We want to bore people with it. The idea that 81% of people, of black people, are responsible, or, you know,
81% of the deaths of white people are because black people have killed them. Yes. Well,
yeah, yeah.
But Trump has also continued to claim that the Central Park Five are guilty, despite the fact that they've been exonerated, that somebody has confessed to the crimes. Is that another way of sending a message to his base?
Yes,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, do we have any sense of how many Americans are considered alt-right? Is this a massive movement? Is this enough to get you elected president?
I don't think it's that big, and we don't have any. In fact, last week I was talking to a pollster, and he was asking me, like, how would he even poll and find out whether somebody would be considered to be affiliated with the alt-right. So we don't have any hard data on how many Americans consider themselves to be part of the alt-right. But I think the thing that you need to think about is that while he has appealed to the alt-right with his rhetoric and with his policies, that same rhetoric and policies appeals to people who wouldn't consider themselves to be part of the alt-right but are just coming along nonetheless. Maybe they're more attracted to his broad Make America Great Again or his promise to bring back manufacturing or coal mining jobs. So I think it's hard to ferret that out at this point. I would hope that at some point we'd be able to get some polling data so that we would have harder numbers. But I think that his popularity signifies a growth in the alt-right, I would think, but also a validation in their mind that somebody who so hews to their ideology could become a major party nominee.
Some people say have claimed that the Republican Party has been moving in this direction ever since the Southern segregationist Democrats like Strom Thurmond and Jesse Helms changed and became Republicans. Does the Republican Party now need to consider including some of the alt-right ideas into its platform going forward, or to try to distance itself in the future?
I think if the Republicans want to remain a viable political entity, they're going to have to distance themselves. But, you know, time will tell on that. Go ahead,
well,
Sarah.
Well, I think the other thing to remember here is that the alt-right despises the Republican Party and movement conservatism. Those are the people they consider to be, in their words, the cuck-servatives who've been demasculinized. So their aim is to replace movement conservatism and destroy the Republican Party. I mean, maybe if they thought that the Republican Party could be a vessel for their ideology, they would be happy with it. But I think the thing to keep in mind about the alt-right that distinguishes it from, say, the Tea Party movement is that they don't consider themselves to be some sort of outgrowth of the Republican Party. They see themselves as a completely new outside movement that wants to replace movement conservatism.
A listener asked this question. Why hasn't the anti-Semitic fringe been put off by Ivanka not only marrying an observant Jew but converting to Judaism? And another of his daughters also dating a Jew.
Oh, they are put off by that stuff, and they'll mention it. They don't like that. They think Trump is way too friendly with Israel, for instance, and so they always qualify their support for him in that regard. But they, nonetheless, they're powerfully excited by his candidacy because they see themselves progressing their agenda under him.
What happens if, as is now being predicted by most credible polls, Donald Trump loses and doesn't and doesn't concede. Some of these people have declared that there'll be armed resistance.
Yeah, I think that not just some of these people, we're seeing a wave of it, especially, interestingly, coming more from the patriot slash militia movement than we are necessarily from the alt-right, although obviously there has been some alt-right expressions of it. A recent Ramsey Paul video, for instance, basically told people to start organizing for the revolution after the election. But we're actually seeing a lot more activity in this regard from the militia patriot segment of the far right, which is actually a sort of distinct entity from the alt-right. And they are, you know, I mean, we just had the arrest of these three guys in Kansas who were plotting to set off Timothy McVeigh-style truck bombs in the middle of a Muslim community. And they were going to kill hundreds of people if they had succeeded. And they're going to do it the day after the election.
How much has the emergence of the alt-right been a result of 8 years of Barack Obama being in the White House?
Well, I think it's hard to disentangle it from it being a reaction to the first black president. But I think it's bigger than that. I mean, it's in terms of its motivations. It's not just a reaction to Obama's presidency, but I think that played a role.
I thank you both. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that definitely happened during the Obama administration is that it became more broadly acceptable to sort of make these sly racist remarks. And really, Trump lifted the lid off that. And it's now widely acceptable, I mean, especially on social media, for people to just be outrageously racist. And, you know, we're seeing people drive around with trucks with big signs with swastikas and stuff on it. You know, all kinds of things. It's as though Trump basically gave people permission to be racist again. But that stuff had been building for definitely all through the 8 years. And there was a lot of wink and nudge and dog whistling going on during the whole Tea Party phenomenon. And it just kept building and building. And I think it just kind of came together under Trump.
David Neiwert and Sarah Posner, their article, How Trump Took Hate Groups Mainstream, is in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. It was reported in partnership with the investigative fund at the Nation Institute. My great thanks to both of them for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.